Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 29th of September 2021 and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine and Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service. And today, Phil, we've got company again. Not just one, but two guests joining us. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I hope we have two guests, because our second guest, it depends whether his airplane lands on time.
Yeah, that's true.
He's going to dial in from an airport somewhere.
Yeah, doing it on the hoof. So fingers crossed for that one. But while he's going through customs, let's talk about other sort of general things. Anything in the news that caught your eye this week?
Well, not in the news, but one thing I wanted to flag up as a follow-up to our last week's conversation. I was complaining that I didn't have a checkbook with new modern banking systems.
Oh, yes.
So I have to send a postal order to DVLA in Swansea. So after we spoke, I went to the post office and said, "I'd like a £25 postal order, please." And they said, "Certainly, sir, that would be £28.12.
Oh.
£3 fee for them to push a button on the till and give me a little piece of paper with the postal.
That's old technology for you, you see.
I was surprised by that. I have to get myself a checkbook. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with the construction industry or what's in the news. I just thought I'd have a quick moan. No, the news story that caught my eye this week was, we've talked before about the huge startup costs that these volumetric house builders, factory building prefabs, house builders, what it's costing them to get critical mass and get up and running. And there's a company called Ilka, we mentioned them before, not Ilkley, but Ilka or Ilky. Like Homes, but not like Homes, they're Ilk Homes, based in Knaresborough. And they borrowed from you and me, the taxpayer, £30 million in back end of 2019. No one ever told us what the terms of the loan were and how much they were paying, but they borrowed £30 million from in 2019. And now they've just tapped us up for another £30 million.
This is a Homes England grant, isn't it?
Yes, but it's public money.
Yeah, I know.
It's
so I'm just going to say, you know, which part of our government did it?
Which bit of us?
Yeah, which bit of us?
Yes.
Yeah.
Home England's Home Building Fund. Now, government policy is to encourage off-site manufacture, and it feels the need to pump prime this industry to give it critical mass, and from it we will all benefit.
Yeah.
So it's government policy to encourage. So on that basis, it's hard to argue with it. And if the government's right, and if Mark Farmer's right, and all the prefab proselytizers are right, we, the taxpayer, are going to get a nice, healthy reward.
Yeah.
In fact, if all these people are right about prefab building, and it is the future, then I'd suggest that Homes England, we, the taxpayer, shouldn't be lending them £60 million. We should be buying £60 million of equity.
Yes.
If we think they're a good bet, let's bet full in. However, I don't really think that, and I feel slightly uncomfortable with £60 million of taxpayer money being lent to one business and not another. I mean, I know other people can get home building funds if they tick the right boxes and so on, but it does all hark back to the old days of government picking winners.
Yes.
Which just makes me slightly uneasy. And on the one hand, you might say, well, this is clearly a winner that we're backing here because it's controlled by the Emirate of Abu Dhabi. But on the other hand, do we think the government should be lending Man City £60 million so that they can buy Harry Kane?
Well,
isn't the logic the same?
No, I suppose it is. I mean, the thing is that when you're picking winners, I mean, I'm not particularly interested in horse racing, but I do know that when you're picking winners, if you know what you're up to, you look at form, don't you? And presumably,
well, there's no form yet.
Well, no, exactly. This is the point. I mean, over the last couple of years, I mean, over the last year, I think. I mean, we've run umpteen stories about Ilke Holmes, or Ilke Holmes, I don't know how you pronounce it actually, actually getting funding for a particular project, or winning a contract to supply. I mean, £31 million worth of funding for 227 homes in Grantham. That was, I think, at the back end of 2019. They've got all these jobs in the pipeline. I don't know how many buildings they've actually erected yet. Do you?
I asked that question. I'll tell you why I asked that question. Because when the Ministry of Housing put out the press release saying, we've lent this company 30 million quid because we love them and we think they're great, okay, and they're going to, you know, we're going to make a profit from them. This is a government press release. It said, as a matter of fact, it didn't say the business plan is that, or the aspiration or the aim is that. It said, as a matter of fact, the government said this, by next year, i.e. 2020, 2,000 modular homes will roll off Ilke Homes' production line, rising to 5,000 homes a year within the next 5 years, making Ilke Homes a top 10 UK house builder. Now, for Ilke to say that in its press release, fine, no problem. Companies, you know, state these things,
yes,
all the time.
It's with a statement of aspiration.
About what,
yeah,
they're going to do. Yes, it's clearly a statement of aspiration. For the government to be saying that as a statement of fact, as a taxpayer, as a journalist, it makes me go, hang on,
yes,
you know, how do you know? Because they certainly didn't see the pandemic coming. In fact, in 2020, Ilke only made just over 1,500 houses.
Right.
That still might be quite good, not bad, but it's not 2,000. No. And therefore, if the first £30 million loan was somehow predicated on that 2,000 modular homes being factory built in 2020 as a fact, and that became not a fact, is Ilke in breach of the terms of its loan? I don't know. I've asked the Homes England what the terms of the loan are. And first of all, I asked Ilke what the terms of the loan are. And I got the answer, we don't have that information. And I'm thinking,
well, if they don't have it, who does?
If they don't, Ilke Homes don't have that information, that's worrying. So I said to Homes England, what are the terms of the loan? What is the current interest? The boilerplate statement is the interest rate is variable and commercially, right, yeah, competitive or some such. But they don't actually say what the interest rate is. And we don't get to see the small print. And so far, at least, they're not telling. So this is a secretive deal. We don't know. I mean, we understand the government policy to promote off-site housing, but I don't think Man City or anyone owned by Abu Dhabi need 30 million of my money.
No. No.
But well, good luck to them. I wish them well, and I'm a big fan of NASBA.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I mean, with backing from one of the Emirates, you'd think that money wouldn't really be an object, and that they could just plough the money in and prove to everybody that off-site manufacturing is the future by doing it. I suppose if the money is available, if another source of money is available, you're stupid not to help yourself to it. But I mean, Ilke Homes hasn't made a profit yet. In fact, I think quite the reverse. It's been making quite a hefty loss, hasn't it, since it was set up, 2017 it was set up? It's only been going about 5 years.
I think its latest accounts are it's 2019 and 2020. I mean, it's made a profit in the past 12 months or not, I don't know.
Right.
But we haven't got its accounts for,
okay,
certainly the past 12 months or more. But in its first 2 years, its latest two sets of accounts, it's lost 50 million quid, roughly speaking, before tax. But as we say, that's the cost,
yeah, that's,
of this
that's
big,
part,
big
part
gamble
of the,
startup.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, lots of people think it's a really, really good gamble. I'm just not sure I want my pocket money being gambled with in that respect.
It's not. You made the point that, you know, why should the government be giving handouts to one particular company? And I don't know whether it's simply because Ilke Homes actually like to trumpet the fact that they're getting the money, and other people are also getting similar loans and aren't telling us about it. But they certainly aren't the only organisation promoting off-site manufacturer. There are numerous other ones out there, aren't there?
Yeah.
So
in all kinds of different ways,
yeah.
I mean, whether it's people making components or roof trusses, or, you know, I've said before, off-site construction means many different things.
They're certainly very visible. I see a lot. Just generally in the news, and obviously we get a lot of press information.
Well, they've got a very expensive PR company working for them, and they've got, you know, TDR Capital, this Abu Dhabi owned private equity house behind them. So there's a lot of money behind them, including 60 million of yours and mine.
Well, now let's introduce our first guest. He is Adrian Atwood, Executive Director of Building Conservation Specialist, DBR, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in its sector, at least in London and the South East. Welcome to Reconstruction, Adrian. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Thank you for having me on the show.
Jolly good. You're currently busy on some very high-profile jobs, aren't you? The Palace of Westminster? You can't get more high profile than that.
Well, certainly. We've been working on Big Ben for the last 4 years, doing all the stonework repair to the external facade and also plaster work internally. And we're also upgrading the historic fire doors to the tower as well. And we've been working at the Palace of Westminster for 20 years on, you know, many other sort of high profile projects there, including Westminster Hall.
Yes. And are you... I mean, we did a piece in the magazine a couple of years ago, I think, about the Elizabeth Tower, which most people just refer to as Big Ben,
That's it, of course. Yeah.
that was Robert McAlpine was the main contractor there. Were you sort of subcontracted to them? Were they sort of project managing it?
Yeah, so Sir Robert McAlpine are the principal contractor and the main contractor for the project, and we're acting as the specialist sort of conservation contractor on certain elements of the fabric.
What stage is that at now? The scaffolding's come off, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's part of the way down. So it's down to sort of getting to the top of the clock faces. The clock mechanisms are going in. And in terms of masonry, we're nearly finished. And I think the scaffolding will be down potentially in sort of Q1, Q2 of next year, because it's quite a long process of dismantle. Mm.
And that's only one part of the Palace of Westminster. Yeah. We're aware that there's an entire, I can't remember how many billions of pounds worth of refurb that needs to go on in the whole of the palace. I guess you're rubbing your hands with glee at that, when that eventually comes, aren't you? When's that ever going to happen?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, we'd like to be involved. It's not a given. We still have to tender for it. So, but, you know, we feel that, you know, we're providing a good service to the palace. So hopefully we'll be in a good position. But the main project, with the repair and renewal program, which, change in terms of value from 3.5 billion to many more billions. That is probably about 5 or 6 years away. So it's probably looking about 2030. But there's a lot of work that's got to be done in advance of that for surveys sort of carrying out sort of lots of feasibility studies, which are currently ongoing at the moment.
But this leads us on, my next question at least, leads us on to why we wanted to talk to you today, Adrian. Because it strikes me that you're saying, well, we hope to get some work on this project. You know, we have to tender for it, but we think we're doing a good job so far. My impression is there's more than enough work for everyone in the building restoration and conservation business on that project. Isn't there? Are there enough people to do this work?
This is the big problem, and this is what we're highlighting at the moment with Year of the Master Craftsperson, our campaign for next year and beyond. And the biggest problem is it's a perfect storm at the moment, what with Brexit, with potential big projects coming up, which will require a great deal of skilled craftspeople. And that's going to cause problems with projects perhaps outside of those major infrastructure and big projects, where there's country houses, churches that still need conservation skills, and many other projects around the country. And with the sort of reduced amount of European labour, skilled labour coming into the country, and also a sort of the process of training to get people to a competent level, it is running into a perfect storm for sure.
It seems to me that historic building conservation is perhaps slightly different from the rest of the construction industry in the way people are recruited and trained. Regular listeners to the podcast, this won't come as any surprise to them, we recently discussed the conservation of the west front of Wells Cathedral by a company called Clifton Conservation. I went to visit that back in the summer, and I spoke to the senior conservator there who made the same point as you. She said it's difficult actually recruiting and training conservators, not so much specialist tradesmen like masons and carpenters, because they've got a very well-defined trade they can go and learn somewhere else. But the wider role of the conservator seems a difficult one to pin down, really. Do you think that's a fair point?
It is very much a fair point. And we've been working with Clifton's on the Elizabeth Tower project. They've been doing the gilding and polychrome work to the clock faces. And, you know, they have the same problem that we have, is that there is a wider skill set. It's not just focused on carpenters and joiners and masons, but there's also stone cleaners, for instance, conservation bricklayers, polychrome specialist conservators, gilders. And on top of that, lead workers as well. And so it's quite a wide problem. And there's the championed trades such as stonemasonry and the unchampioned trades such as stone cleaners. And people say, well, what is a stone cleaner? And these are highly skilled craftspeople who very carefully clean facades and historic fabric. And, you know, if it's been done badly, as quite a lot of work was badly done in the 70s and the 80s, it can do irreparable damage. So it's highly skilled work.
Do you think that maybe it's a bit below the radar for most people coming into the construction industry? They think in terms of becoming a bricklayer or an excavator operator or a crane driver or something like that. They don't really think of themselves as becoming a stone cleaner or even a master craftsman in one of the traditional crafts. Do you think that it's difficult to address potential recruits, more difficult for you than perhaps people in more mainstream trades?
I think it is. And I think it's partly education. It's not a trade or trades that are actually being championed perhaps at school or even at some of the colleges perhaps. And the decisions are made quite early on about careers. And we do need to get to sort of key stage 4 and 5 of school kids to kind of show them that there is actually these trades that are available, these highly skilled trades, and all the rewards that come with them as well. And I think it would open their eyes. I mean, I've done some seminars to key stage 4 and 5, and, you know, just sparking that interest and knowing that there is a vocational career out there, which isn't just mainstream construction. And I think part of the problem is that mainstream construction is being led to be a sort of blue collar menial work, perhaps, when in fact it is highly skilled, whether in mainstream or whether in heritage construction.
I mean, I'm perhaps a bit biased because I like old buildings, and I often look around and I see what people do to old buildings sometimes, even now, although I think perhaps we're generally more enlightened. And I sometimes think that perhaps we need to engender a wider appreciation of our built environment and some of our historic buildings, because it's very easy to get carried away with some of the sort of, you know, big, impressive civil engineering and construction projects, which are, after all, very exciting and very visual, and forget the buildings which are already there and need looking after. So, you know, maybe we need to encourage people perhaps to take a more sensitive look at their built environment and look after the buildings that they already have.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're all walking around great landmarks around the UK. And, you know, just looking above your head to see the, you know, the amount of skill and input that's been put into these historic buildings. Mm. And the passion is a skill which actually, you know, does engender a great deal of passion as well. Working, saving history, carrying out very skilled work, similar to the work that was done, same work that was done by master crafts people, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago and beyond. And also it's very niche as well, because it's a great thing to talk about. You get to see the most amazing parts of buildings that you normally wouldn't get to see. And also, without exception, I find our clients are all very passionate about what is being done to their historic asset. And that does produce an incredibly robust and kind of driven team.
And it's not really just about the, you know, the, we've talked about Palace of Westminster and Wells Cathedral. I mean, these are big ticket buildings. It's not just those big sort of high profile projects. I'd say to anybody listening, next time you walk down your high street, look up. Don't look at the first floor, which is all plate glass and stainless steel. Look up and see the upper stories.
If you're lucky, most of mine are shut.
But I mean, even just the buildings in our high street. So you look up and you see the amount of skilled work which went into the brickwork, the joinery and carpentry in the windows, the stonework, the roofing. It's all there. We're surrounded by it. And of course, these things, it's very easy to let buildings like that, which a lot of them aren't protected at all, just disappear. And I think that would be a real shame.
It is. And I think that is the thing. I mean, you know, there is, when you look up at sort of churches and, you know, sometimes we think we're fairly utilitarian buildings. You know, there's a lot of detailed work, especially with Gothic Revival, where there's incredible tracery. There's, you know, griffins, grotesques, gargoyles and things like that. I mean, I was at a chapel in the middle of Farnborough the other week, and it's a hidden gem. The architecture is immense, and incredibly skilled work went into the construction of that building.
Hmm. So tell us a bit more about the Year of the Master Craftsperson. Is this something that DBR itself has sort of initiated, or is it an industry-wide activity?
So it's something that DBR has initiated to try to help push this need for more craftspeople in the industry. I mean, there is a lot of voices happening at the moment about industry change and about getting more skilled craftspeople into the industry. And the Year of Master Craftsman is not trying to rewrite all of that. It's just trying to add another focus to skilled craftspeople and what they achieve. And it is also to try and enthuse a new generation of skilled craftspeople. And on the other side of the coin, and it's something that we haven't yet discussed, was that the younger generation still need to be trained. And it's not just about training within you know, sort of workshops and with classrooms and lecture theatres. It's also about training out physically on site. And that's where the true skill is realised. But it's got to happen with existing skilled craftspeople. So we have a bit of a double-edged sword here, is that we need to train people with existing craftspeople, but we need more craftspeople. And so it's quite a difficult one, but we've got craftspeople who are getting to the back end of their careers. You know, it's still quite physical work out on site, and we will need to train them to become trainers. So that is an important part of the process, and that's what Year of the Master Craftsman is also trying to champion.
What are the qualifications that young people would be working towards? I think we discussed the other week, David, didn't we, that there is no CSCS, Construction Skills Certification Scheme card for Master Craftsman or Conservator or Restoration Specialist. And I'm not even sure the Construction Industry Training Board has this on its radar, does it? I mean, what's the framework for qualifications?
So there's, I mean, like anything with the education industry, it does change regularly. You know, historically there was the indentured sort of time served craft approach, then the NVQs, and now we're into apprenticeships and trailblazers. And so there's quite a lot of things changing and happening within the education, but there is, the CITB are doing great work. I mean, they have got, they do see it as a challenge, and they are, you know, doing a lot of work on this, as is lots of other organisations.
They are involved in looking after old buildings as well as building new ones. I hadn't realised that.
Okay. Yeah, they are. And skilled trades. I mean, on the CITB, I think the recognition is that, I mean, the stonemason, for instance, is in the top 10 of the jobs within the construction industry, which is good to hear. Mm. And Historic England are doing a great deal. They've had a lot of grant money come through from the Hamish Ogston Foundation. So they're championing education and craft skills as well. So there is quite a lot of organisations that recognise not just, you know, craft skills sort of shortage, but general construction shortage as well. So there are things happening, but I think it's a bit of a minefield as well, trying to understand, especially if you want to try and get into the industry, is where do you go to try and join this all up and understand the best approach and what skill you would like to achieve?
This is just an idle observation, but when I visited Wells Cathedral, everybody I met there was a woman. And I looked on your website and on your page about us, the majority of the people who appear there are also women. Now, is that just pure coincidence, or is there something about historic buildings conservation that appeals to women in some way?
So the interesting thing is there's probably more female conservators than there are conservators who are doing polychrome and lots of those sort of very analytical and very sort of careful and, you know, conservation of surfaces and gilding. In terms of masonry, the balance is very much more on the male side for men. Mm. But there are more women coming into stone masonry as well. So that is changing. So there is a bit of a mix. On my team, from the management point of view, nearly half my team are women as well, who are who are project managers and construction managers, specializing in historic building conservation. So the mix is getting better. It's great to see. It really is. I think we need to probably get more women into the stonemasonry side of things. But the balance is kind of the other way, perhaps, on conservators.
Well, it's interesting that here's a little niche sector of the construction industry which seems to have addressed the gender imbalance in construction, because normally we hear from all sides how, you know, we need to encourage more women into the construction industry. Sounds like companies like DBR are doing that already.
We are, and I think it's just amazing, because the dynamic is fantastic with, you know, that mix, and it's important. And women play a very good role within construction as well as men. So it's an important balance for the future.
And one thing that came out of my look at the Wells Cathedral story was that, to train as a conservator, it's generally a higher education route, isn't it? That you can now go and study for a bachelor's degree in historic building conservation. I think Lincoln University is a leader in that sort of sector.
They are, and they're doing great work in terms of getting professional qualifications in historic building conservation. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a lot of other providers. The Building Crafts College, for instance, is doing that. So as training providers, they're also doing collaborations with universities to provide, undergraduate courses and master's courses as well. And West Dean College is another great provider of heritage skills training.
Okay. I'm getting the sense that the work that you do, building restoration and conservation, it's kind of the missing link between archaeology and construction, and that maybe what your profession needs is your very own Indiana Jones to capture the public imagination.
Well, there definitely does. I mean, we do need to sort of cross that link between one and the other, and it's also upskilling as well. Again, it's upskilling people who have either not in the construction industry whatsoever, but have a very, you know, a great deal of passion and dexterity to carry, you know, to become a practitioner. And it's also upskilling existing construction trades to take them to another level. So, say a bricklayer, maybe then want to become a conservation bricklayer. So dealing with gauge brick arches, tuck pointing, and all those sort of things, which are being lost effectively as a skill.
But would you be more looking to hijack potential bricklayers or hijack art students who maybe aren't going to be the next Damien Hirst or David Hockney?
Both, actually. I mean, it's everybody has the ability to become a skilled craftsperson. I seriously believe that. And and there is so much talent out there. It's just being able to give people the opportunity, and also for them to realise that there is a very niche industry. And, you know, I feel that it's always good to have your general background training and then go specialist, because you know, because your ability to, you know, command greater salaries, to work on those amazing projects, becomes you know, becomes much more focused.
You just mentioned salaries. That was going to be my next question. Does it pay better than other types of construction work?
Not necessarily. That can be a bit of an issue. So say, for instance, bricklaying at the moment, we all know with the construction and house building programs and what have you, and the reduced number of bricklayers perhaps are available because of the of Brexit problems, then, you know, it's supply and demand. And that is always going to be a problem. But salaries, you know, are reasonable. They're, you know, and the ability to achieve a good salary in a specialism becomes, you know, the you know, there's more ability to actually get a higher salary, I think, when you're a specialist. And there's, you know, limited supply and good demand.
It's interesting that you mentioned earlier about, you know, how we need to get you know, keep these skills alive and get people trained up, because, you know, bricklaying is highly skilled, and the little I know about it, you know, there's a multitude of different bonds and all sorts of different techniques involved. Very highly skilled job. Plastering, very highly skilled job. Carpentry, stonemasonry, they are all, these are, you know, historic skills which require an awful lot of time and application to acquire. And yet the mainstream construction industry is doing, seems to be doing its best to make them obsolete. I mean, you know, you get prefabricated brick panels now, which are not really bricks at all, but they look like bricks. And, you know, that's delivered to site. You can get prefabricated masonry made out of plastic and fiberglass and stuff like that. The old skills, perhaps, you know, we still need them for the historic fabric, you know, the historic built environment, but they're required less and less, perhaps, in mainstream
new
construction
build.
Outside of, yeah, in new build, yeah, particularly in sort of the larger, perhaps, you know, commercial side of things. Maybe, you know, high quality house building, you still need those skills, people still value them. But if you're developing a town centre, I mean, I can remember reading and writing something about the redevelopment of Canterbury. Canterbury was my local city growing up, and it was 1960s development, basically, because it had been bombed in the war. And then they decided to tart it up, and all these sort of neo sort of Georgian buildings went up. And I was horrified to learn that most of the sort of limestone coins are actually made out of expanded polystyrene with a sort of a nice hard skin on the outside. And it's a bit demoralizing sometimes to realize that that is what, you know, that's what goes now in the commercial construction sector. And if you want those skills, you've got to pay for them. And a lot of people would prefer to go the cheap route.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's got to be a balance. I mean, for, you know, house building and construction, I mean, there's such a great demand that actually getting skilled tradespeople in sufficient numbers is going to be difficult for sure. And labour is expensive compared to perhaps doing prefabricated units. So I think that in mainstream construction, there's got to still be innovation. I see these kind of YouTube things of kind of robots laying bricks and what have you. I mean, yeah. I'm not entirely sure the efficacy of it. I'm sure maybe it would work in some instances. So there is a place for it. But within historic building conservation, mechanizing on-site trades, I think, is incredibly difficult, if not nigh impossible, because we're still trying to replicate, you know, the master crafts work that was done, you know, hundreds of years, you know, when the building was perhaps constructed. And that would be difficult to automate on site.
Yeah.
So it's got to be the skilled hand, effectively.
So if anybody wants to know more about the year of the master craftsperson, which is next year, 2022, is there a website they can visit? How can they find out more about events being organised, that kind of thing?
So at the moment, what we're doing is, it's still in its early stages. We're still working with potential partners on the Year of the Master Craftsperson. And so we're going to start building sort of a hub against our existing website, which is dbrlimited.com. So we'll see over the next few months that that website hub will be developing as a link to our main company website. It might be that as partners get more and more involved with it, that they will then start to introduce the campaign within their own websites, and we can then run the links for our own company website as well. So I think the best first port of call would be dbrlimited.com website, and then that would probably lead to other hubs. So it's still in its sort of development stages at the moment, but we have got a great deal of interest from industry partners, both from mainstream construction and also from the heritage sector.
Good stuff.
Brilliant. Adrian, thank you very much indeed.
It was great. Great talking to you. Thanks very much. And good luck with the events next year.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Adrian.
Cheerio.
Cheers.
Let's introduce our next guest. He is Tobias Nischel, who is Managing Director of a company called Punch Flybrid. It's a company specialising in energy storage of a type that you might be unfamiliar with because it's kinetic energy in the form of a flywheel. Punch Flybrid has been in the news recently because it has formed a partnership with Select Plant, which is planning to use the company's technology to improve energy efficiency in its tower crane fleet. Well, welcome, Tobias. I understand that you're joining us from not your normal location. Where are you at the moment?
That's right. Yes, I'm currently at the Milan airport.
Okay.
I'm traveling to one of our companies within the Punch Group that is located in Turin. And there, over the next days, we are presenting our advancements in hydrogen internal combustion engines. Also, a very interesting topic.
Wow! So you have more than one string to your bow. But we're going to talk about the flywheel concept today, because I mean, certainly I was unfamiliar with this idea of storing energy in the form of a flywheel. Can you tell us a little bit more about it, how it works and how you developed it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So we believe that it will become more and more unacceptable to waste energy. And that doesn't really matter where the energy is coming from, if that is a fossil fuel or if that's HVO or if that's maybe even energy coming from renewable sources. If you waste it, it will become more and more unacceptable. And so unfortunately, for generators that are running on construction sites, often they are used quite dynamically. And unfortunately, that means that if they're used dynamically, they waste energy. And we are coming from a motorsport background. So we developed our technology originally for Formula One racing.
Oh, right. And,
you know, Formula One is also an application where it's very dynamic duty cycle, right? I think everybody can imagine that a Formula One racing car is constantly either accelerating as fast as it can or slowing down as fast as it can. And so it uses, you know, fossil fuel at the moment to turn the chemical energy of that fuel into kinetic energy into the vehicle. And then when the driver stamps on the brakes, it turns all of that kinetic energy into heat on the friction brakes, yeah, right? And all that heat just gets lost. And so that is a very inefficient way to, you know, use this really, you know, valuable fuel, fossil fuel that was created over millions and millions of years to then turn it all into heat on the brakes. And so Formula One racing, wanted to have hybrid systems in the sports. And that is when Flybrid was founded, back in 2007. And we really at the beginning looked all of the different ways how you can store energy. And there are huge amounts of ways, right? You can store it in knotted rubber bands or in clockwork springs or in hydraulic accumulators or in chemical batteries, or you can store it in flywheels.
And if a flywheel is just a spinning disc, simply, isn't it? It's not high tech.
You're right. The principle is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years old, right? The flywheels have been used in pottery wheels for I don't know how many centuries, right? So the principle technology is not new, right? But the innovation that we are adding to it is to create a flywheel that has a very high power density. So how much power you can release the energy with for its mass, and also has a very, very good energy density. And to do that with materials that are conventional, that you can, recycle very easily, you know, and that you can produce anywhere where there's industry, right? So this is one of the beauties of flywheels, is that it only consists of steel and the casings are aluminium. So you can leverage all of the know-how that we have built up here in Europe for processing these materials in internal combustion engines, in vehicles, right? And you can create an energy storage system. You know, you don't have any strange chemicals in the flywheel or some materials that need to be, that have a defined area where you can mine them. You know, you can produce a flywheel anywhere in the world. And that I think that's really important also for the political side of things, of how we do our energy provision in the future. But yeah, to come back to it, the thing is with the flywheels in motorsport, we had our flywheel spinning at over 60,000 RPM.
Wow.
Okay. And so then on the outside of the flywheel, we had speeds of close to Mach 2, so twice the speed of sound. Okay.
Okay.
And so then we ran the flywheel in a vacuum to reduce the air friction and to not have sonic booms, right? That's okay. Quite handy to not have those. Yeah. And so yes, the principle of a flywheel is very old, but then how you turn that into a product for the 21st century, you know, this is where the innovation is in. And, you know, we used motorsport because the environment is really nice, right? The motorsport is big budget. It's really fast paced. You get instant feedback of the technology advances that you do because you have a race almost every weekend. So either you make the car faster or you don't, right? So it's a really, really fast development process. And, you know, in that time when we were in motorsport, we filed more than 50 patents. We were probably the first company who had the Formula One spec cars running on the dyno at full performance. We provided the hybrid system for the first ever hybrid race car that raced at the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Wow.
But, you know, at the end of the day, right, even if we managed to fit every Formula One car with one of our systems, frankly, who cares, right? I mean, it's just a few Formula One cars driving around. So what really drives us is making a change with these flywheels and saving fuel and emissions. Mm. And this is where it comes in the construction sector. Because, you know, the flywheel works best in applications where there's very dynamic duty cycles. And when you look at how a generator is used that powers a tower crane, that has actually, you know, it's used for many, many hours, much more hours than people drive their road cars or their Formula One cars, right? And it has actually quite a high power. So it uses quite a lot of energy over those time. And so if you can make a change to that system, you can save a huge amount of energy and huge amount of fuel, huge amount of emissions. And this is really what drives us in applying this technology for the construction industry.
You were sort of forced to go to find new markets, weren't you? Because they changed the rules of Formula One. You thought you had a winning yeah, business. Well, and then suddenly your business was shut down overnight by the rule makers. So you thought, right, now where do we go?
Yeah, it was luckily not overnight, but it is true. We are currently banned in all of the major motorsport series, which is, again, the automotive industry, the light-duty automotive industry is going very heavily into full electric vehicles, right, where the battery is the energy storage system. And batteries and flywheels have very different characteristics, right? So we would never design a flywheel where you can drive a vehicle for 200 miles without using the engine, right? If you would do that, the flywheel would be the size of a house. You know, that would be completely the wrong use of the technology, right? But if you need to cycle your energy storage very frequently and at high power, you know, batteries tend to get quite hot and heat is again wasted energy. And also batteries have a cycle life of around 2000 to maybe 4000 cycles, something like this. And you know, again, for light duty application, that's plenty, right? So if you can drive 200 miles with one cycle of your battery charge and you do that 3000 times, you have a 600,000 mile range before you need to replace the battery. That's enough for a road car, right?
Sure.
But in some of these heavy duty applications, we see energy cycle events every 20 seconds, right? And these things are not operated only for, you know, a few thousand hours. You know, an excavator, for example, is operated for 15,000 hours, right? And we are fitted to wind turbines at the moment. The wind turbine runs 7 days a week, 365 days, you know, and it has a life of 80,000 hours. So, you know, for this, you get so many millions of charge and discharge cycles. You need a different technology. And, you know, in Formula One racing, where a race only lasts 2 hours, you can get away with a lot of abuse of your energy storage system, right? Because after 2 hours, nobody cares anymore. But if you stick it in an excavator, or you stick it in a city bus, or you stick it on a genset that powers a tower crane, well, then you have to have something that lasts. Because at the end of the day, it's also about the full life cycle emissions, right? There's no point, or very little point, to have a zero emission technology if it takes a huge amount of energy to create it, or if it's really difficult to recycle it, or if it has a life that's shorter than the time it takes to make back these emissions that are created from producing it in the first place, right? And so the flywheels tend to score really well on full life cycle emissions, because there's not much energy required to create it. They save a really good amount of fuel, and they are very easily recyclable. Like any material part out of steel or aluminium, you can just melt it in and make another one at the end of it. And so applications with really long life and really harsh duty cycles, this is where the flywheels fit in.
And I guess a tower crane is a good example of that, because a tower crane will hang around on hovering over a site doing nothing for hours on end, maybe. And then it's required to lift heavy loads. And so there's this fluctuation of inactivity followed by a lot of activity in a short period of time. So I suppose that's where,
yes,
where having a flywheel spinning away quietly somewhere is better than having a diesel generator just ticking over and emitting fumes everywhere.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, David. Yeah, so tower crane is a really nice application because, as you say, for a good chunk of the of its operation during the day, it's the generator is mostly idling. Mm. But then when the tower crane lifts a load, it suddenly gets a big kick of having to deliver power suddenly and straight away, right? And so because of this, currently you need to fit quite a really big engine, internal combustion engine, to deal with this big rise in power in order for the frequency and the voltage not drop so much that the crane doesn't function anymore, right? And so when you look at a measurement of how much power is being used by a tower crane, you typically have to size currently the generator 2 to 3 times bigger than the average load that the generator actually uses throughout the day.
Yeah.
And this is where our product comes in. So what we are doing is, we are acting as a little bit of a parasitic load on the generator, right? So we are taking fuel from the generator to turn that into electricity, to then use that electricity to drive an electric motor, which spins up our flywheel, right? So, so first of all, that doesn't sound good because we are burning fuel to spin the flywheel up. Okay. But bear with me. And then what we are doing, because we have that energy in the flywheel, we can now inject the energy exactly when it's required at high power rates and very, very quickly. And that means that actually we don't need to run that massive generator that's 3 times bigger than the average load. We can now run a generator that is optimized around the average load, and it operates in a really nice, narrow operating band around its peak efficiency point. So it burns really, really efficiently. And then when it gets that big kick from the tower crane and needs to deliver power, instead of having to suddenly jump up, we are injecting energy from the flywheel, and the flywheel deals with all the spikes. Mm-hmm. And that means that the generator can deal with the average load. And like this, you can optimize both systems.
So what you're saying is that you can use a smaller generator, much smaller generator, and therefore you're using less fuel.
Absolutely right.
How much less fuel are we talking about? You've done quite a few tests by now, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we are on a number of construction sites across the UK. And we have seen, so it always depends a little bit on the size of the generator, right? So I think the smallest generator that we have downsized was from a 200 kVA down to a 100 kVA generator. There we are saving around 9,000 liters of fuel per year. Mm. And so the biggest one is a massive 800 kVA generator. So that's one that is powering, that's what we're doing together with the partnership with Select. So that's powering a 66-ton Luffing crane. It's normally 800 kVA. And we replaced that with a 320 kVA generator now. So and that means that we are saving more than 30,000 liters per year of fuel. And that is 80 tons of CO2. And that comes back to my point about, what if we would fit a system to every Formula One car? Who cares, right? Because 80 tons of CO2, if you convert that into how much the average UK driver drives their car, and across a fleet of all cars on the road in the UK, what is their average fuel consumption? And so therefore, how much emissions do they produce? If you convert that, it means that we are saving 100% of the emissions of more than 50 cars by fitting one of our systems to a single tower crane. Right. And this is what I mean. This is why we are so fired up. Right. So, you know, we are much better effect of putting flywheels onto tower cranes because we're saving so much of the fuel and so much of the emissions, much more than if you would fit a system to every car on the street, if that makes sense.
And with the red diesel rebate ending, that 30,000 litre saving becomes very interesting because fuel is about to get much more expensive for the construction industry next April, May.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, again, an innovation is worth nothing if it doesn't work commercially, right? And the construction industry, you know, this is not some, you know, some Formula One game where it's all about performance and how much it costs doesn't matter, right? In the construction industry, it's about total cost of ownership. And it really needs to work commercially because, yes, everybody is trying to save fuel and emissions, but not for spending more money with it. And so the trick is that with our product, where you get the saving is that on the one hand, you can downsize your generator significantly. So you get a cost saving from that, either if you buy the generator or if you rent it. And then on top of it, whenever you run it, you get the fuel saving. And those two mean that you get a really quick return on investment. On this case of this 800 kVA genset, you can pay for the cost of the system already from downsizing. And from day one, you're saving money basically from both the rental charge and from the fuel saving.
But even if the generator is not fueled by diesel, if it's a hydrogen generator or a solar generator, the flywheel will still save power, won't it? Oh, you got another plane came past.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely right. It's a really important point to make because when we speak to the construction companies, a lot of them, they actually don't, you know, they would like to run their equipment more from the mains connection, right? Rather than using a generator at all, you know, and on a lot of construction sites, there is a certain amount of mains power available to power the equipment. But often what we find is that power is not enough to power all of the equipment. So they tend to run the welfare units maybe on the grid connection and then the really heavy hitting tower cranes or concrete pumps or something on a generator. And what we are telling to these people is that, you know, the flywheel also works with a grid connection. You know, you can cover the load spikes from these equipment. And that means that you need less grid power for your construction site. And ultimately that means that we believe we can put more of the construction sites on grid power than otherwise would be possible. Ah. And that is obviously then also a huge fuel and emission saving because you can use the grid rather than using a diesel genset or a HVO genset. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a big advantage. So, I mean, this device that Select is using, I think it's called the Punch Power 200 box. It's basically just a cube, isn't it? There's nothing to look at from the outside.
Yes.
Is the flywheel inside, is that ever sort of just freewheeling or is it always under power? It's always being spun up by something, by either a generator or by the mains electricity?
Yeah, exactly. So in the application for the construction industry, we always have the flywheel spinning up. It's different than in automotive or motorsport, where we're using the kinetic energy of the vehicle to spin it up. But in the construction industry, what we want to do is we want to have energy available when this big power demand comes. And we don't necessarily know when the power demand comes. And in fact, that is one of the key features of our box that we have created. We wanted to make it as applicable to any generator as possible. And so what we are doing is we are basically, you plug in the back a three-phase cable of our box, and then that three-phase cable you connect to the bus bars of the generator. And then our system is looking at the microgrid between the load, so that could be the tower crane or the concrete pump or whatever, and the generator. And we are monitoring what is the frequency and what is the voltage on that microgrid. And if the frequency or the voltage drop below a configurable value, we inject the energy. So we're always trying to keep it at 50 hertz and 400 volts.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And like this, we don't need to know what the generator is actually powering. If that is a concrete pump or a tower crane, we don't care. We don't need to know who's the manufacturer of the generator. We don't need to plug into it. You know, it can be any, can be any yeah. fuel source, whatever. And that makes it very flexible. And it means you can just rock up to a construction site, connect the cable, and within 15 minutes, you are saving fuel. And that is, again, another really key important difference to automotive or motorsport, you know, where where you take years to integrate a system into a machine so that it fits in the really tight packaging space, right? Here we have made it all as a flexible box. We rock up, we connect it, and we're saving fuel. And that's very nice.
I can really see that that's a big advantage for a tower crane, where you've got your power box sitting there, a static unit there. I know this is not really relevant to construction. Well, it might be if we're talking about a mobile plant, but I wonder how a big flywheel works in a mobile machine, especially a Formula One car, because anybody who knows what gyroscopes do. Is they actually keep things steady. They prevent you moving and orienting. Anybody who's had a toy, I don't know if you had one when you were a boy, Phil. It was a gyroscope.
I remember having one.
String around it, and you had a little Eiffel Tower, and it'd sit on top of it.
Didn't have that bit.
And you could make it go round, and it process. How do you? It's for steadying things, gyroscopic navigation, all that sort of stuff. How do you make your Formula One car go around corners if you've got bloody great big flywheel spinning in the back?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The flywheels are used for a number of different cases, and there the trick is again in the speed of the flywheel. And you know, in Formula One, I mean, don't get me started on all the motorsport stuff, right? Because otherwise, okay. we need more time. But in Formula One. The fastest corner is in Suzuka, and the Formula One cars go around there with over 300 kilometers per hour, 200 miles per hour. And so they have 5G of lateral force going around it, right? And when you do the calculations, the gyroscopic forces of the flywheel in that corner are actually less than the gyroscopic forces of the engine turning around. Oh. And the trick is in having the flywheel spinning so quickly, because the kinetic energy equation, the speed goes in as a square. So it's half times the inertia of the flywheel, which is basically the mass, times the speed squared. So if you can spin a flywheel twice as fast, you only need a quarter of the mass to store the same amount of energy. And the gyroscopic calculation is just a linear relationship. So by spinning the flywheel quicker, you have less gyroscopic forces. And that is, you know, that is a big difference compared to the flywheels that we are using, compared to the flywheels in the 1950s or whatever that are cast iron, you know, 500 kilograms and spinning at 1,000 RPM, you know. You can get the same energy storage by spinning 60,000 RPM, but only using 5 kilograms, you know, so this is the kind of difference.
Tobias, I suspect most of our listeners are far more interested in hearing you talk about Formula One than talking about tower cranes. However, this podcast is called Reconstruction, so I'm going to drag it back to the construction sites. Do people buy the, what's your business model? Do people buy these boxes off you or rent them? And how many of these, your flywheel boxes, punch flybrid boxes are on UK construction sites at the moment? What's happening in the marketplace?
Yeah, so how the business model that we are following is that we are selling our systems usually to either generator rental companies or to the people who rent the tower cranes or the equipment. And the reason for that is that we are obviously a newcomer into this market. So we are reliant also on people to distribute the idea around flywheels. It's a new technology. It's not something that everybody thinks of straight away when they think about energy storage. And you know, we are working really with the experts in the field, like, for example, Select Plant Hire, right? They are like one of the biggest UK plant rental businesses. And, you know, they are experts in their field, and we are collaborating together. We are leveraging their experience, they're leveraging our experience to create a product that is innovative, but that's sustainable and that works commercially for the end customers, who are the construction companies.
Well, I had a conversation with a guy called Dave Shooter, the crane manager at Bowmer and Kirkland, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, Dave is great.
And
he's an amazing guy.
He was saying that he's had it on I don't know, I can't remember if it was one or more than one of his sites, and he now wants your technology on every single, everywhere, on every crane he's got, on every site that Bowman Kirkland have got a crane. The only issue now at the moment is getting hold of these things. Is that I think you're, well, I won't say that you're struggling, but how are you managing to keep up with demand? My impression is demand is starting to come quite quickly, and it might be a bit of a challenge for you.
Yeah, it's we are ramping up production. It's all planned. So, but yeah, for sure, we have at the moment more demand than units around us. But we are very quickly ramping up. And the nice thing about that is that we are part of a large organization, right? We are quite small in the UK. But the punch part of Lipid is a privately owned business with close to 2,000 employees, 500 million euro turnover. And, you know, they are experts in producing very complex automatic transmissions in high volume. We can leverage the engineering resources of our sister company here in Turin. And so that really helps us to ramp up quickly and get everything into the market at a good pace. But yeah, so we are currently producing the next batch of 50 systems. They are all going, almost all of them are sold now. And we are running at the moment at a rate of making them at 5 units per week, and we are going towards 10 units per week. So that is the plan. That's what's being actioned. But maybe just one thing to say about Dave Shooter, because I really want to make that point as well. You know, I know so many people who don't take the first step, right? Who say, oh yeah, all nice technology, Tobias. I see you when you have them in production, right? And I see you when you have a few hundred sold, right? So these guys, you know, I can give you a list as long as my arm, you know, who are the guys who don't dare to take the first step. And Dave Shooter is a guy who's on the other end, you know. Dave Shooter is a guy, he puts his money where his mouth is, and he encourages new technologies like ours to go into the market. And without people like Dave Shooter, you know, we would not be able to have these systems in the marketplace. Because of course, when you have a new product coming to the market, at the beginning, it is something that's not known, and that is maybe scary for people, and they rather want to let other people try it out first. So I'm very thankful for people like Dave Shooter, for people like Select, like Sunbelt, John F. Hunt, you know, Stuart Energy, all these guys who made the first steps, and without them, it wouldn't be possible.
We need more Daves.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant.
Great
stuff. Tobias, thank you very much indeed for your time. And if listeners thought there was some noise in the background, as we mentioned before, you are at Milan Airport. Have you just arrived or are you just leaving?
No, I've just arrived. I have a few days here, and then Friday I will fly back home to my family.
But Punch is Punch, the parent company is Italian, is it?
No, actually, so the mother company is Belgian. We have a big site in France, in Strasbourg, and we have another site in Italy. Then we have also some colleagues in Slovakia, and obviously our facility in the UK.
You're based in Silverstone still, aren't you, from your Formula One days? You're still in Silverstone.
Yes, exactly. We're about you know, a few hundred yards from the last corner to the old start finish straight. So when there's a fruity car outside, we hear it in our offices, even with the windows closed. It's quite an environment.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much indeed for giving us your time, and we'll speak again, I'm sure.
Thanks a lot, Tobias.
Yeah, pleasure to speak with you both. Thank you very much.
Bye. Well, I thought
you'd enjoy him.
Yeah, really, really good. Yeah, fantastic. It seems such a simple technology, but I can really see that that would make a real difference. We didn't ask him about cost, but I imagine that it can't be that expensive.
I have had that conversation with him previously, and I have to flick through my notebook, but it does seem to pay for itself quite quickly. Certainly. Mentioned Dave Shooter at Bowman Kirkland. When it comes to cost, it's an absolute no-brainer, and becomes even more of a no-brainer when the red diesel rebate ends.
Sure.
And as I say, I asked the question, I can't remember, within a former conversation with Tobias or with Dave at Bowman Kirkland, that if this is a diesel-based product, aren't you aren't you at risk of buying, you know, a fax machine when email's just about to come in? And say, well, no, it doesn't matter what the, as Tobias saying there, it doesn't matter what the energy source is. This technology will save it. We'll use less of it. Yeah. We'll only use the amount that you should be using without wastage.
I think we're going to see a lot more of that. Yeah, it's a fascinating technology.
Well, that's all we've got for this week, folks. I say all we've got. That was a bumper edition, I'm sure you'll agree. But thank you very much to Adrian Atwood and to Tobias Nischel. We've covered some ground once again, from Big Ben to Formula One. We'll be back again, same sort of time, next week. Hope you can join us. We'll be here. But from Dave and I, goodbye.
See you then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.